An injection, eh? Jamie looked unenthusiastic. Claire did that to me once. I didn't like it a bit. Did it work?
Jamie merely grunted in reply and tore off another small morsel of meat between his teeth. In spite of his worry, Roger wolfed his share of the meat and the uneaten part of Jamie's meal as well. The sky spread black and starry overhead, and a cold wind moved through the trees, chilling hands and face. He buried the remnants of the snake. All they needed now was for some large carnivore to show up, drawn by the smell of blood, and tended the fire, all the time listening for a shout from the darkness. No sound came but the moaning of wind and cracking of branches. They were alone. Fraser had pulled off his hunting shirt, in spite of the chill, and was sitting with his eyes closed, swaying slightly. Roger squatted next to him and touched his arm. Jesus, the man was blazing hot to the touch. He opened his eyes, though, and smiled faintly. Roger held up a cup of water. Jamie nodded and took the cup, fumbling. The leg was grotesquely swollen below the knee, nearly twice its normal size. The skin showed irregular dark red blotches, as though some succubus had come to place its hungry mouth upon the flesh, then left unsatisfied. Roger wondered uneasily whether he might perhaps be wrong. He'd been convinced that the past couldn't be changed. Ergo, the time and manner of Fraser's death was set, some 4 years in the future. If it weren't for that certainty, though, he thought he'd be bloody worried by the look of the man. Just how certain was he, after all?
You could be wrong.
Jamie had put down the cup and was regarding him with a steady blue gaze.
About what? He asked,
startled to hear his thoughts spoken aloud. Had he been muttering to himself, not realizing it?
About the changing. You thought it wasn't possible to change history, you said. But what if you're wrong?
Roger bent to poke the fire.
I'm not wrong, he said firmly, as much to himself as to Fraser. Think, man. You and Claire, you tried to stop Charles Stuart, change what he did, and you couldn't. It can't be done.
That's no quite right, Fraser objected.
He leaned back, eyes half hooded against the fire's brightness.
What's not right?
It's true we failed to keep him from the rising, but that didn't depend only on us and on him. There were a good many other folk had to do with that. The chiefs who followed him, the damn Irishmen who flattered him, even Louis, him and his gold.
He waved a hand, dismissing it.
Well, that's neither here nor there. You said Claire and I couldn't stop him. And it's true, we couldn't stop the beginning. But we might have stopped the end. Culloden, you mean?
Roger stared into the fire, remembering dimly that long-ago day when Claire had first told him and Brianna the story of the stones, and Jamie Fraser. Yes, she had spoken of a last opportunity, the chance to prevent that final slaughter of the clans. He glanced up at Fraser.
By killing Charles Stuart?
Aye, if we had done so. But neither she nor I could bring ourselves to it.
His eyes were nearly closed, but he turned his head restlessly, clearly uncomfortable.
I've wondered many times since if that was decency or cowardice. Or maybe something else, Roger said abruptly. You don't know. If Claire had tried to poison him, I'm betting something would have happened. The dish would have spilled, a dog would have eaten it. Someone else would have died. It wouldn't have made a difference.
Fraser's eyes opened slowly.
So you think it's all destined, do you? A man has no free choice at all.
He rubbed at his mouth with the back of his hand.
And when you chose to come back for Brianna, and then again for her in the wain. It wasn't your choice at all, I. You were meant to do it.
Roger stopped, hands clenched on his thighs. The smell of the Gloriana's bilges seemed suddenly to rise above the scent of burning wood. Then he relaxed and gave a short laugh.
Hell of a time to get philosophical, isn't it? Aye, well.
Fraser spoke quite mildly.
It's only that I may not have another time.
Before Roger could expostulate, he went on.
If there is nae free choice, then there is neither sin nor redemption, aye? Jesus,
Roger muttered, shoving the hair back from his forehead.
Come out with Hawkeye and end up under a tree with bloody Augustine of Hippo.
Jamie ignored him, intent on his point.
We choose, Claire and I. We wouldna do murder. We wouldna shed the blood of one man. But does the blood of Culloden then rest on us? We wouldna commit the sin, but does the sin find us still? Of course not.
Roger rose to his feet, restless, and stood poking the fire.
What happened at Culloden? It wasn't your fault. How could it be? All the men who took part in that, Murray, Cumberland, all the chiefs, it was not any one man's doing. So you think it is all meant? We're doomed or saved from the moment of birth and not a thing can change it. And you a minister's son.
Fraser gave a dry sort of chuckle.
Yes,
Roger said, feeling at once awkward and unaccountably angry.
I mean, no. I don't think that. It's only... Well, if something's already happened one way, how can it happen another way? It's only you that thinks it's happened,
Fraser pointed out.
I don't think it. I know.
Mm-hmm.
Aye, because you've come from the other side of it. It's behind you. So perhaps you couldn't have changed something. But I could, because it's still ahead of me.
Roger rubbed a hand hard over his face.
That makes...
He began, and then stopped. How could he say it made no sense? Sometimes he thought nothing in the world made sense any more.
Maybe, he said wearily. God knows, I don't.
Aye.
Well, I suppose we'll find out soon enough.
Roger glanced sharply at him, hearing a strange note in his voice.
What do you mean by that? You think you can that I died 3 years from now?
Fraser said calmly.
If I die tonight, then you're wrong, aye. What you think happened won't have happened. So the past can be changed, aye. You're not going to die,
Roger snapped. He glowered at Fraser, daring him to contradict.
I'm pleased to hear it, Fraser said. But I think I'll take a bit of the whiskey now. Draw the cork for me, aye. My fingers will not grasp it.
Roger's own hands were far from steady. Perhaps it was only the heat of Fraser's fever that made his own skin feel cold as he held the flask for his father-in-law to drink. He doubted that whiskey was recommended for snakebite, but it didn't seem likely to make much difference now.
Lie down, he said gruffly when Jamie had finished. I'll fetch a bit more wood.
He was unable to keep still. There was plenty of wood to hand, yet still he prowled the darkness, keeping just within sight of the blazing fire. He had had a lot of nights like this, alone under a sweep of sky so vast that it made him dizzy to look up, chilled to the bone, moving to keep warm. The nights when he had wrestled with choice, too restless to lie in a comforting burrow of leaves, too tormented to sleep. The choice had been clear then, but far from easy to make. Brianna on the one hand, and all that came with her, love and danger, doubt and fear. And on the other, surety. The knowledge of who and what he was. A certainty he had forsaken, for the sake of the woman who was his, and the child who might be. He had chosen. Damn it, he had chosen. Nothing had forced him. He had made the choice himself. And if it meant remaking himself from the ground up, then he'd bloody well chosen that, too. And he'd chosen to kiss Morag, too. His mouth twisted at the thought. He'd had even less notion of the consequences of that small act. Some small echo stirred in his mind, a soft voice far back in the shadows of his memory.
What I was born does not matter. Only what I will make of myself. Only what I will become. Who'd written that, he wondered. Montaigne? Locke? One of the bloody Enlightenment lads, them and their notions of destiny and the individual? He'd like to see what they had to say about time travelling. Then he remembered where he'd read it, and the marrow of his spine went cold. This is the grimoire of the witch Gilles. It is a witch's name, and I take it for my own. What I was born does not matter, only what I will make of myself, only what I will become.
Right, he said aloud, defiant. Right, and you couldn't change things either, could you, Grandma?
A sound came from the forest behind him, and the hair rose on the back of his neck before he recognised it. It wasn't laughter, as he'd thought at first, only a panther's distant cry.
She had, though, he thought suddenly. True, she'd not managed to make a king of Charles Stuart, but she'd done a good number of other things. And now he came to think on the matter. She and Claire had both done something guaranteed to change things. They'd born children to men of another time. Brianna, William Buccleuch. And when he thought of the effect those two births had had on his own life, let alone anything else, that had to change things, didn't it? He sat down slowly on a fallen log, feeling the bark cold and damp under him. Yes, it did. To name one minor effect, his own bloody existence was the result of Geely Duncan's taking charge of her destiny. If Geely hadn't borne a child to Dougal Mackenzie. Of course, she hadn't chosen to do that. Did intention make any difference, though? Or was that exactly the point he'd been arguing with Jamie Fraser?
He got up and circled the fire quietly, peering into the shadows. Fraser was lying down, a humped shape in the darkness, very still. He walked lightly, but his feet crunched on the needles. Fraser didn't twitch. His eyes were closed. The blotchiness had spread to his face. Roger thought his features had a thick, congested look, lips and eyelids slightly swollen. In the wavering light, it was impossible to tell whether he was still breathing. Roger knelt and shook him hard.
Hey, are you still alive?
He'd meant to say it jokingly, but the fear in his voice was apparent to his own ears. Fraser didn't move. Then one eye cracked open.
Aye, he muttered, but I'm no enjoying it.
Roger didn't leave again. He wiped Jamie's face with a wet cloth, offered more whiskey, which was refused, then sat beside the recumbent form, listening for each rasping breath. Much against his will, he found himself making plans, proceeding from one unwelcome assumption to the next. What if the worst happened? Against his will, he thought it possible. He'd seen several people die who didn't look nearly as bad as Fraser did just now. If the worst should happen, and the others not have returned, he would have to bury Jamie. He could neither carry the body nor leave it exposed, not with panthers or other animals nearby. His eye roamed uneasily over the surroundings. Rocks, trees, brush, everything looked alien, the shapes half masked by darkness, outlines seeming to waver and change in the flickering glow, the wind moaning past like a prowling beast. There, maybe. The end of a half-fallen tree loomed jagged in the darkness, leaning at an angle. He could scrape a shallow trench, perhaps, then lever the tree and let it fall to cover the temporary grave. He pressed his head hard against his knees.
No, he whispered. Please, no.
The thought of telling Bree, telling Claire, was a physical pain stabbing him in chest and throat. It wasn't only them, either. What about Jem? What about Fergus and Massali, Lizzie and her father, the Bugs, the Lindsays, the other families on the ridge? They all looked to Fraser for confidence and direction, What would they do without him? Fraser shifted and groaned with the movement. Roger laid a hand on his shoulder and he stilled.
Don't go, he thought, the unspoken words balled tight in his throat. Stay with us. Stay with me.
He sat for a long time, his hand resting on Fraser's shoulder. He had the absurd thought that he was somehow holding Fraser, keeping him anchored to the earth. If he held on till the sunrise, all would be well. If he lifted his hand, that would be the end. The fire was burning low now, but he put off from moment to moment the necessity of tending it, unwilling to let go.
Mackenzie.
It was no more than a murmur, but he bent at once.
Aye, I'm here. You want water? A drop of whiskey?
He was reaching for the cup even as he spoke, spilling water in his anxiety. Fraser took two swallows, then waved the cup away with a twitch of his hand.
I dinna ken yet if you're right or you're wrong, Fraser said.
His voice was soft and hoarse, but distinct.
But if you're wrong, wee Roger, and I'm dying, there are things I must say to you. I dinna want to leave it too late. I'm here, Roger repeated, not knowing what else to say.
Fraser closed his eyes, gathering strength, then brought his hands beneath him and rolled halfway over, ponderous and clumsy. He grimaced and took a moment to catch his breath.
Bonnet, I must tell you what I've put in train.
Hi.
For the first time, Roger felt something other than simple worry for Fraser's welfare.
There is a man named Lion. Duncan Innes will ken best how to find him. He works on the coast, buying from the smugglers who run the outer banks. He sought me out at the wedding to see would I deal with him over the whisky.
The plan in outline was simple enough. Jamie meant to send word, by what route Roger had no notion, to this Lion, indicating that he was willing to enter into business, provided that Lion would bring Stephen Bonnet to a meeting, to prove that he had a man of the necessary reputation and skill to manage the transport up and down the coast.
Necessary reputation? Roger echoed under his breath. Aye, he's got that.
Fraser made a sound that might have been a laugh.
He'll not agree that easily. He'll bargain and set terms, but he'll agree. Tell him you've got enough whisky to make it worth his while. Give him a barrel of the two-year-old to try, if you must. When he sees what folk will pay for it, he'll be eager enough. The place?
He stopped, frowning, and breathed for a moment before going on.
I'd thought to make it Wiley's Landing. But if it's you, you should choose a place to your liking. Take the Lindsays with you to guard your back, if they'll go. If not, find someone else, then I'll go alone. And go ready to kill him at the first shot.
Roger nodded, swallowing heavily. Jamie's eyelids were swollen, but he looked up under them, his eyes glinting sharp in the firelight.
Dinna let him get close enough to take you with a sword, he said. You've done well, but you're no good enough to meet a man like Bonnet. And you are?
Roger couldn't stop himself from saying. He thought Fraser was smiling, but it was difficult to tell.
Oh, aye, he said softly. If I live.
He coughed then and lifted a hand, dismissing Bonnet for the moment.
For the rest, watch Sinclair. He's a man to be used. He kens everything that passes in the district, but no a man to turn your back on, ever.
He paused, brow furrowed in thought.
You can trust Duncan Innes and Farquhar Campbell, he said. And Fergus. Fergus will help you, if he can. For the rest.
He shifted again and winced.
Go wary of Obadiah Henderson. He'll try you. A many of them will, and you let them. But dinna let Henderson. Take him at the first chance. You will na get another.
Slowly, with frequent pauses to rest, he went down the list of the names of the men on the ridge, the inhabitants of Cross Creek, the prominent men of the Cape Fear Valley. Characters, leanings, secrets, obligations. Roger fought down panic, struggling to listen carefully, commit it all to memory, wanting to reassure Fraser, tell him to stop, to rest, that none of this was necessary. At the same time, knowing it was more than necessary. There was war coming. It didn't take a time traveller to know it. If the welfare of the Ridge, of Brianna and Jemmy, of Claire, were to be left in Roger's inexperienced hands, he must take heed of every scrap of information that Fraser could give him. Fraser's voice trailed off in hoarseness. Had he lost consciousness? The shoulder under Roger's hand was slack, inert. He sat quietly, not daring to move. It wouldn't be enough, he thought, and a dull fear settled in the pit of his stomach, an aching dread that underlay the sharper pangs of grief. He couldn't do it. Christ, he couldn't even shoot a thing the size of a house. And now he was meant to step into Jamie Fraser's shoes, keep order with fists and brain, feed a family with gun and knife, tread the tight rope of politics over a lighted powder keg, tenants and family all balanced on his shoulders. Replace the man they called himself? Not fucking lightly, he thought bleakly. Fraser's hand twitched suddenly. The fingers were swollen like sausages, the skin stretched, red and shiny. Roger laid his free hand over it and felt the fingers move, trying to curl around his own.
Tell Brianna I'm glad of her, Fraser whispered. Give my sword to the bairn.
Roger nodded, unable to speak. Then, realising that Fraser couldn't see him, cleared his throat.
Aye, he said gruffly. I'll tell her.
He waited, but Fraser said no more. The fire had burned very low, but the hand in his burned hot as embers. A gust of wind knifed past, whipping strands of his hair against his cheek, sending up a spray of sudden sparks from the fire. He waited as long as he thought he dared, the cold night creeping past in lonely minutes. Then leaned close so Fraser could hear him.
Claire, he asked quietly, is there anything you'd have me tell her?
He thought he'd waited too long. Fraser lay motionless for several minutes. Then the big hand stirred, half-closing swollen fingers, a ghost of emotion, grasping after time that slipped away.
Tell her. I meant it.
This ends Disc 37. The Fiery Cross, Disc 38.
Chapter 91. Domestic Management.
I've never seen anything like that in my entire life.
I leaned closer, peering.
That is absolutely bizarre.
And you a healer half your life, Jamie muttered crossly. You cannot tell me they've got no snakes in your time.
They haven't got many in downtown Boston. Besides, they wouldn't call out a surgeon to deal with a case of snake bite. Closest I came was when a keeper at the zoo was bitten by a king cobra. Friend of mine did the autopsy and invited me to come and watch.
I refrained from saying that Jamie looked a lot worse at present than the subject of the autopsy had. I set a hand gingerly on his ankle. The skin was puffy, hot and dry under my hand. It was also red, bright red. The brilliant colour extended from his feet up nearly to his ribcage. He looked as though he'd been dipped in boiling water. His face, ears and neck were also flushed, the colour of a plum tomato. Only the pale skin of his chest had escaped, and even that was dotted with pinpricks of red. Beyond the lobster-like coloration, the skin was peeling from his feet and hands, hanging in wispy shreds like Spanish moss. I peered closely at his hip. Here I could see that the redness was caused by a denser version of the rash on his chest. The stipple of tiny dots showed up clearly on the stretched skin over the ileal crest.
"You look like you've been roasted over a slow fire," I said, rubbing a finger over the rash in fascination. "I've never seen anything so red in my life."
Not raised. I couldn't feel the individual spots, though I could see them at close range. Not a rash as such. I thought it must be petechiae, pinpoint hemorrhages under the skin. But so many of them.
I shouldn't say you have much room to criticise, Sassenach, he said.
Too weak to nod, he cut his eyes at my fingers, stained with huge blotches of yellow and blue.
Oh, damn! I leapt to my feet, threw the quilts hastily on top of him, and ran for the door.
Distracted by Jamie's dramatic arrival, I had left a vat full of dyeing to mind itself in the side yard, and the water had been low. Christ, if it boiled dry and burned the clothes! The hot reek of urine and indigo hit me in the face as I shot out the door. In spite of that, I drew a deep breath of relief as I saw Massali, red in the face with the effort of levering a dripping mass from the pot with the big wooden clothes fork. I went hastily to help her, snatching the steaming garments one by one from the sopping pile and flinging them onto the blackberry bushes to dry. "Thank goodness," I said, waving my scalded fingers in the air to cool them. I was afraid I'd ruined the lot.
"Well, they'll be a bit dark, maybe."
Massali wiped a hand across her face, plastering back the fine blonde strands that escaped from her kerch.
"If the weather keeps fine, though, you can leave them in the sun to feed. Here, let's move the pot before it scorches."
Crusts of indigo had already started to crackle and blacken in the bottom of the pot as we tipped it off the fire, and clouds of acrid smoke rose up around us.
"It's all right," Massali said, coughing and fanning smoke from her face. "Leave it, Mother Clare. I'll fetch up water so it can soak. You'll need to see to Da, aye? I came down at once when I heard. Is he very poorly?"
"Oh, thank you, dear."
I was overwhelmed with gratitude. The last thing I had time to do just now was to haul several buckets of water from the spring to soak the pot. I blew on my scalded fingers to cool them. The skin under the splotches of dye was nearly as red as Jamie's.
"I think he'll be all right,"
I assured her, suppressing my own fears. "He feels dreadful and looks worse. I've never seen anyone look like that in all my born days. But if the wound doesn't get infected..." I crushed my sore fingers in superstitious prophylaxis.
"Aye, he'll do," Massali said confidently. "Fergus said as they thought he was dead when they found him and Roger Mac, but by the time they crossed the second ridge, he was making terrible jokes about the snake, so they didn't worry any more."
I wasn't quite so sanguine myself, having seen the state of his injured leg, but I smiled reassuringly.
"Yes, I think he'll be fine. I'm just going to make an onion poultice and clean out the wound a bit. Go and see him, why don't you, while I fetch the onions."
Luckily, there were plenty of onions. I had pulled them 2 weeks before, when the first frost came, and dozens of knobbly braided strings hung in the pantry, fragrant and crackling when I brushed against them. I broke off 6 large onions and brought them into the kitchen to slice. My fingers were tingling, half-burned and stiff from handling the boiling clothes, and I worked slowly, not wanting to slice off a finger accidentally.
"Here, I'll do that, Alannon."
Mrs. Bug took the knife out of my hand and dealt briskly with the onions.
"Is it a poultice? Aye, that'll be the thing. A good onion poultice will mend anything."
Still, a worried frown puckered her forehead as she glanced toward the surgery.
"Can I help, Mama?"
Bree came in from the hallway, also looking worried.
"Da looks awful. Is he all right?" "Kind of full."
Jem popped into the kitchen after his mother, less worried about his grandfather than interested in the knife Mrs. Bug was using. He dragged his little stool toward her, face purposeful under his coppery fringe.
"Me too."
I brushed the hair out of my face with the back of my hand, eyes watering fiercely from the onions.
"I think so."
I sniffed and blotted my eyes.
"How's Roger?"
"Roger's good."
I could hear the small note of pride in her voice. Jamie had told her Roger had saved his life. Possibly he had. I just hoped it stayed saved.
"He's asleep," she added.
Her mouth curved slightly as she met my eyes with complete understanding. If a man was in bed, at least you knew where he was, and that he was safe for the moment. "Jem, you leave Mrs. Bug alone." She scooped him off his stool and whirled him away from the chopping board, feet kicking in protest. "Do you need anything, Mama?" I rubbed a finger between my brows, considering. "Yes. Can you try to find me some maggots? I'll need them for Jamie's leg." I frowned, glancing out the window at the bright autumn day. "I'm afraid the frost has killed all the flies. I haven't seen one in days. Try the paddock, though. They'll lay eggs in the warm dung." She made a brief face of distaste, but nodded, setting Jemmy down on the floor. "Come on, pal. Let's go find Icky's for Granny."
"Icky, Icky, Icky."
Jemmy scampered after her, enchanted at the prospect. I dropped the sliced onions into a bowl made from a hollowed gourd and scooped a little of the hot water from the cauldron into it. Then I left the onions to stew and went back to the surgery. In the centre of the room was a sturdy pine table, serving as examination table, dentist's chair, drug preparation surface, or auxiliary dining table, depending on medical exigencies and the number of dinner guests. At the moment, it was supporting the supine form of Jamie, scarcely visible under his heap of quilts and blankets. Masali stood close to the table, head bent toward him as she held a cup of water for him to sip. "You're sure you're all right, Da?" she said. One hand stole toward him, but she stopped, clearly afraid to touch him in his present condition.
"Oh, aye. I'll do."
I could hear the deep fatigue in his voice, but a big hand rose slowly out from under the quilt to touch her cheek.
"Fergus did braw work," he said. "Kept the men together through the night. Found me and Roger Mack in the morning. Brought everyone home safe across the mountain. He's a fine sense of direction."
Masali's head was still bent, but I saw her cheek curve in a smile.
"I did tell him so. He'll no give over berating himself for letting the beasts get away, though. Just one would have fed the whole ridge for the winter," he said.
Jamie gave a small grunt of dismissal.
"Oh, he'll manage."
It was plainly an effort for him to speak, but I didn't try to send Masali away. Roger told me Jamie had been vomiting blood as they brought him back. I couldn't give him brandy or whiskey to ease the pain, and I hadn't any laudanum. Masali's presence might help to distract him from his wretchedness. I opened the cupboard quietly and brought out the big lidded bowl where I kept my leeches. The pottery was cold, soothing to my scalded hands. I had a dozen or so big ones, somnolent black blobs half floating in their murky brew of water and cattail roots. I scooped three into a smaller bowl full of clear water and set it by the brazier to warm.
"Wake up, lads," I said. "Time to earn your keep."
I laid out the other things I would need, listening to the murmured conversation behind me. Jermaine, baby Joan, a porcupine in the trees near Masali and Fergus's cabin. Coarse gauze for the onion poultice, the corked bottle with its mixture of alcohol and sterile water, the stoneware jars of dried golden seal, coneflower and comfrey, and the bottle of penicillin broth. I cursed silently, looking at the label on it. It was nearly a month old. Caught up in the bear hunt and the autumn chores upon our return, I hadn't made a fresh batch for weeks. It would have to do. Pressing my lips together, I rubbed the herbs between my hands into the beechwood brewing cup, and with no more than a faint sense of self-consciousness, silently said the blessing of bride over it.
I'd take all the help I could get. "Are the cut pine fans you find on the ground very fresh?" Jamie asked, sounding slightly more interested in the porcupine than in Joan's new tooth.
"Aye, green and fresh. I ken well enough he's up there, the wicked creature. But it's a great huge tree, and I canna spot him from the ground, let alone fire on him."
Masali was no more than a middling shot, but since Fergus couldn't fire a musket at all with his one hand, she did the family's hunting.
"Mm-hmm."
Jamie cleared his throat with an effort, and she hastily gave him more water.
Take a bit of salted pork rind from the pantry and rub it over a stick of wood. Set it on the ground, not too far from the trunk of the tree, and let Fergus sit up to watch. Porcupines are gay fond of the salt and of grease. They'll smell it and venture down after dark. Once it's on the ground, you needn't waste shot. Just bat it over the head. Fergus can do that fine.
I opened the medical chest and frowned into the tray that held saws and scalpels. I took out the small, curve-bladed scalpel, its handle cool under my fingers. I would have to debride the wound, clean away the dead tissue, the shreds of skin and bits of leaf and cloth and dirt. The men had plastered his leg with mud and wrapped it with a filthy neckerchief. Then I could sprinkle the penicillin solution over the exposed surfaces. I hoped that would help.
That would be grand, Massali said, a little wistfully.
I've no had such a beast before, but Ian did tell me they were fine, very fat, and the quill's good for sewing and all manner of things.
I bit my lip, looking at the other blades. The biggest was a folding saw meant for field amputation, with a blade nearly 8 inches long. I hadn't used it since Alamance. The thought of using it now made cold sweat spring out under my arms and inch down my sides. But I'd seen his leg.
"The meat's greasy," Jamie said. "But that's good."
He stopped abruptly as he shifted his weight, with a muffled groan as he moved his leg. I could feel the steps of the process of amputation echoing in the muscles of my hands and forearms, the tensile severing of skin and muscle, the grate of bone, the snap of tendon, and the slippery, rubbery, blood-squirting vessels sliding away into the severed flesh like snakes. I swallowed. No, it wouldn't come to that. Surely not.
You need fat meat. You're very thin of yearning, Jamie said softly behind me. Too thin for a woman breeding.
I turned round, swearing silently to myself once more. I'd thought so, but had hoped I was wrong. 3 babies in 4 years! And a one-handed husband who couldn't manage the man's work of a homestead and wouldn't do the women's work of baby-minding and mash-brewing that he could handle. Massali made a small sound, half-snort, half-sob.
How did you know? I haven't even told Fergus yet.
You should, though he kens it already.
He told you?
No, but I didn't think it only the indigestion that troubled him whilst we were hunting. Now I see you. I ken what it is that's weighing on him.
I was biting my tongue hard enough to taste blood. Did the tansy oil and vinegar mixture I'd given her not work? Or the Darko seeds? Or, as I strongly suspected, had she just not bothered to use either one regularly? Well, too late for questions or reproaches. I caught her eye as she glanced up and managed, I hoped, to look encouraging.
Oh, she said with a feeble smile. We'll manage.
The leeches were stirring, bodies stretching slowly like animated rubber bands. I turned back the quilt over Jamie's leg and pressed the leeches gently onto the swollen flesh near the wound.
It looks nastier than it is,
I said reassuringly, hearing Masali's unguarded gasp at the sight. That was true, but the reality was nasty enough. The slash marks were crusted black at the edges, but still gaped. Instead of the sealing and granulation of normal healing, they were beginning to erode, the exposed tissues oozing pus. The flesh around the wounds was hugely swollen, black and mottled with sinister reddish streaks. I bit my lip, frowning as I considered the situation. I didn't know what kind of snake had bitten him. Not that it made much difference, with no anti-venom for treatment, but it had plainly had a powerful hemolytic toxin. Tiny blood vessels had ruptured and bled all over his body, internally as well as externally, and larger ones near the site of the wound. The foot and ankle on the injured side were still warm and pink, or rather red. That was a good sign, insofar as it meant the deeper circulation was intact. The problem was to improve circulation near the wound, enough to prevent a massive die-off and sloughing of tissue. The red streaks bothered me very much indeed, though. They could be only part of the hemorrhagic process, but it was more likely that they were the early signs of septicemia. Blood poisoning. Roger hadn't told me much of their night on the mountain, but he hadn't had to. I'd seen men before who'd sat through the dark with death beside them. If Jamie had lived a night and a day since then, chances were he would go on surviving, if I could control the infection. But in what condition? I hadn't treated snake bite injuries before, but I'd seen sufficient textbook illustrations. The poison tissue would die and rot. Jamie could easily lose most of the muscle of his calf, which would cripple him permanently. Or worse, the wound could turn gangrenous. I stole a look at him under my lashes. He was covered with quilts and so ill he could barely move, and yet the lines of his body were drawn with grace and the promise of strength. I couldn't bear the thought of mutilating him, and yet I would do it if I must. To cripple Jamie, to leave him halt and half-limbed. The thought made my stomach clench and sweat break out on my blue-blotched palms. Would he wish that himself? I reached for the cup of water by Jamie's head and drained it myself. I wouldn't ask him. The choice was his by right. But he was mine, and I had made my choice. I wouldn't give him up, no matter what I had to do to keep him. "You sure you're all right, though?" Massali had been watching my face. Her eyes darted from me to Jamie and back, looking scared. I hastily tried to rearrange my features into a look of competent assurance. Jamie had been watching me, too. One corner of his mouth turned up. Well, I did think so. Now I'm none so sure, though. "What's the matter? Do you feel worse?" I asked anxiously. "No, I feel fine," he assured me, lying through his teeth. "It's only when I've hurt myself, but it's all right. You always scold like a magpie. But if I'm desperate bad, you're tender as milk. Now, you haven't called me wicked names or uttered a word of reproach since I came home, Sassenach. Does that mean you think I'm dying?" One eyebrow rose in irony, but I could see a true hint of worry in his eyes. There were no vipers in Scotland. He couldn't know what was happening to his leg. I took a deep breath and laid my hands lightly on his shoulders. "Bloody man, stepping on a snake. Couldn't you have looked where you were going?" "Not whilst chasing 1,000 weight of meat downhill," he said, smiling. I felt a tiny relaxation in the muscles under my hands, and repressed the urge to smile back. I glared down at him instead. "You scared bloody hell out of me." That at least was sincere. The eyebrow went up again.
"Maybe you think I wasn't a frightened too."
"You're not allowed," I said firmly. "Only one of us can be scared at a time, and it's my turn." That made him laugh, though the laughter was quickly succeeded by coughing and a shaking chill. "Fetch me a hot stone for his feet," I said to Massali, quickly tucking in the quilts around him, "and fill the teapot with boiling water, and bring that too." She darted hastily toward the kitchen. I glanced toward the window, wondering whether Brianna was having any luck in finding maggots. They had no equal in cleaning pustulant wounds without damage to the healthy flesh nearby. If I was to save his leg as well as his life, I needed more help than St. Bride's. Wondering vaguely if there were a patron saint of maggots, I lifted the edge of the quilt and stole a quick look at my other invertebrate assistants. "Good." I let out a small sigh of relief. The leeches worked fast. They were already swelling into plumpness, sucking away the blood that was flooding the tissues of his leg from ruptured capillaries. Without that pressure, healthy circulation might be restored in time to keep skin and muscle alive. I could see his hand clenched on the edge of the table and could feel the shuddering of his chill through my thighs, pressed against the wood. I took his head between my hands. The skin of his cheeks was burning hot.
"You are not going to die," I hissed. "You're not. I won't let you."
"People keep saying that to me," he muttered, eyes closed and sunken with exhaustion. "Am I not allowed my own opinion?"
"No," I said. "You're not. Here, drink this."
I held the cup of penicillin broth to his lips, steadying it while he drank. He made faces, squinching his eyes shut, but swallowed it obediently enough. Masali had brought the teapot brimful of boiling water. I poured most of it over the waiting herbs and left them to steep while I poured him a cup of cold water to wash away the taste of the penicillin. He swallowed the water, eyes still shut, then lay back on the pillow.
"What's that?" he asked. "It tastes of iron."
"Water," I replied. "Everything tastes of iron. Your gums are bleeding."
I handed the empty water jug to Masali and asked her to bring more.
"Put honey in it," I said. "About one part honey to four parts water."
"Beef tea is what he needs," she said,
pausing to look at him, brow furrowed with concern.
"That's what my mam did swear by, and her mam before her. When a body's lost a deal of blood, there's not like beef tea."
I thought Masali must be seriously worried. She seldom mentioned her mother in my hearing, out of a natural sense of tact. For once, though, bloody Lyra was right. Beef tea would be an excellent thing, if we happened to have any fresh beef, which we didn't.
"Honey water," I said briefly, shooing her out of the room.
I went to fetch reinforcements from the leech department, pausing to check on Brianna's progress through the front window. She was out by the paddock, barefoot, skirts kilted up above the knee, shaking bits of horse dung from one foot.
"No luck so far, then."
She saw me at the window and waved, then motioned to the axe that stood nearby, then to the edge of the wood. I nodded and waved back. A rotted log might be a possibility. Jemmy was on the ground nearby, his leading strings securely tied to the paddock fence. He certainly didn't need them to help him stay upright, but they did keep him from escaping while his mother was busy. He was industriously engaged in pulling down the remnants of a dried gourd vine that had grown up over the fence, crowing with delight as bits of crumbled leaf and the dried remains of frost-bitten gourds showered over his flaming hair. His round face bore a look of determined intent as he set about the task of getting a gourd the size of his head into his mouth. A movement caught the corner of my eye. Masali, bringing up water from the spring to fill the crusted cauldron. No, she wasn't showing at all yet. Jamie was right. She was much too thin. But now that I knew, I could see the pallor in her face and the shadows under her eyes.
Damn.
Another glimpse of movement. Bree's long, pale legs flashing under her kilted skirts in the shadow of the big blue spruce. And was she using the tansy oil? She was still nursing Jemmy, but that was no guarantee, not at his age. I swung around at a sound behind me, to find Jamie climbing slowly back into his nest of quilts, looking like a great crimson sloth, my amputation saw in one hand.
"What the hell are you doing?"
He eased himself down, grimacing, and lay back on the pillow, breathing in long, deep gasps. The folded saw was clasped to his chest.
"I repeat," I said, standing menacingly over him, hands on my hips. "What the hell?"
He opened his eyes and lifted the saw an inch or two.
"No," he said positively. "I ken what you're thinking, Sassenach, and I will na have it."
I took a deep breath to keep my voice from quivering. "You know I wouldn't, not unless I absolutely had to."
"No,"
he said again, and gave me a familiar look of obstinacy.
No surprise at all that he never wondered who Jemmy looked like, I thought with sour amusement.
"You don't know what may happen."
"I ken what's happening to my leg better than you do, Sassenach,"
he interrupted, then paused to breathe some more.
"I dinna care."
"Maybe you don't, but I do."
"I'm no going to die,"
he said firmly. "And I dinna wish to live with half a leg. I've a horror of it."
"Well, I'm not very keen on it myself. But if it's a choice between your leg and your life..."
"It's not."
"It damn well may be."
"It won't."
Age made not the slightest difference, I thought. 2 years or 50, a Fraser was a Fraser, and no rock was more stubborn. I rubbed a hand through my hair. "All right," I said, between clenched teeth. "Give me the bloody thing and I'll put it away."
"Your word."
"My what?" I stared at him.
"Your word,"
he repeated, giving me back the stare with interest.
"I may be fevered and lose my wits. I dinna want you to take my leg if I'm no in a state to stop it."
"If you're in that sort of state, I'll have no choice."
"Perhaps you don't," he said evenly. "But I do. I've made it." "Your word, Sassenach."
"You bloody, unspeakable, infuriating..." His smile was startling, a white grin in the ruddy face.
"If you call me a Scot, Sassenach, then I know I'm going to live."
A shriek from outside kept me from answering. I swung round to the window in time to see Massali drop 2 pails of water on the ground. The water geezered over her skirt and shoes, but she paid no attention. I glanced hastily in the direction she was looking and gasped. It had walked casually through the paddock fence, snapping the rails as though they were matchsticks, and stood now in the midst of the pumpkin patch by the house, vines jerking in its mouth as it chewed. It stood huge and dark and woolly, 10 feet away from Jemmy, who stared up at it with round, round eyes and open mouth, his gourd forgotten in his hands. Massali let out another screech, and Jemmy, catching her terror, began to scream for his mother. I turned, and feeling as though I were moving in slow motion, though I was surely not, snatched the saw neatly from Jamie's hand, went out the door and headed for the yard, thinking as I did so that buffalo looked so much smaller in zoos. As I cleared the stoop, I must have leapt. I had no memory of the steps. Brianna came out of the woods. She was running silently, axe in her hand, and her face was set inward and intent. I had no time to call out before she reached it. She had drawn back the axe, still running, swung it in an arc as she took the last step, and brought it down with all her strength just behind the huge beast's ears. A thin spray of blood flew up and spattered on the pumpkins. It bellowed and lowered its head as though to charge forward. Bree dodged to one side, dived for Jemmy, was on her knees, tugging at the strings that bound him to the fence. From the corner of my eye, I could see Massali yelling Gaelic prayers and imprecations as she seized a newly dyed petticoat from the blackberry bushes. I had somehow unfolded the saw as I ran. I cut Jemmy's strings with 2 swipes, then was on my feet and running back across the dooryard. Massali had thrown the petticoat over the buffalo's head. It stood bewildered, shaking its head and swaying to and fro, blood showing black on the yellow-green of the fresh-dyed indigo. It stood as tall as I at the shoulder, and it smelt strange, dusty and warm, gamey but oddly familiar, with a barn smell like a cow. It took a step, another, and I dug my fingers into its wool, holding on. I could feel the tremors running through it. They shook me like an earthquake. I had never done it, but felt as though I had, 1,000 times. Dreamlike and sure, I ran a hand under slobbering lips, felt warm breath blow down my sleeve. The great pulse throbbed in the angle of the jaw. I could see it in my mind, the big meaty heart and its pumping blood warm in my hand, cold against my cheek where it pressed the sodden petticoat. I drew the saw across the throat, cut hard, and felt it in hands and forearms, the tensile severing of skin and muscle, the grate of bone, the snap of tendon, and the slippery, rubbery, blood-squirting vessel sliding away. The world shook. It shifted and slid and landed with a thud. When I came to myself, I was sitting in the middle of my dooryard, one hand still twisted in its hair, one leg gone numb beneath the weight of the buffalo's head, my skirts plastered to my thighs, hot and stinking, sodden with its blood.
Someone said something, and I looked up. Jamie was on his hands and knees on the stoop, mouth open, stark naked. Massali sat on the ground, legs splayed out in front of her, soundlessly opening and closing her mouth. Brianna stood over me, Jemmy held against her shoulder. Terror forgotten, he leaned far over, looking down in curiosity at the buffalo.
"Ooh," he said.
"Yes," I said.
"Very well put."
"You're all right, Mama?" Bree asked. And I realized she had asked several times before. She put down a hand and rested it gently on my head.
"I don't know," I said. "I think so."
I took her hand and laboriously worked my leg free, leaning on her as I stood up. The same tremors that had gone through the buffalo were going through her and me, but they were fading. She took a deep breath, looking down at the massive body. Lying on its side, it rose nearly as high as her waist. Massali came to stand beside us, shaking her head in awe at its size.
"Mother of God, how on earth are we going to butcher that?" she said.
"Oh," I said, and dragged a trembling hand through my hair. "I suppose we'll manage." Chapter 92. I get by with a little help from my friends. I leaned my forehead against the cool glass of my surgery window, blinking at the scene outside. Exhaustion lent the scene in the dooryard an extra tinge of surrealism, not that it needed much extra. The sun had all but set, flaming gold in the last ragged leaves of the chestnut trees. The spruces stood black against the dying glow, as did the gibbet in the centre of the yard, and the grisly remains that swung from it. A bonfire had been lit near the blackberry bushes, and silhouetted figures darted everywhere, disappearing in and out of flames and shadow. Some attacked the hanging carcass, armed with knives and hatchets. Others plodded laden away, carrying slabs of flesh and buckets of fat. Near the fire, the skirted bell shapes of women showed, bending and reaching in silent ballet. Dark as it was, I could pick Brianna's tall, pale figure out of the horde of demons hacking at the buffalo, keeping order, I thought. Before being forcibly returned to the surgery, Jamie had estimated the buffalo's weight at something between 1,800 and 2,000 pounds. Brianna had nodded at this, handed Jemmy to Lizzie, then walked slowly around the carcass, squinting in deep thought. "Right," she'd said, and as soon as the men began to appear from their homesteads, half-dressed, unshaven and wild-eyed with excitement, had issued cool directions for the cutting of logs and the building of a pulley frame capable of hoisting and supporting a ton of meat. The men, disgruntled at not being in on the kill, hadn't been inclined to pay attention to her at first. Brianna, however, was large, vivid, strongly spoken, and stubborn. "Whose stroke is that?" she demanded, staring down Geordie Chisholm and his sons as they started toward the carcass, knives in hand. She pointed at the deep gash across the neck, then wiped her hand slowly down her sleeve, drawing attention to the splashed blood there. "Or that?" One long bare foot pointed delicately at the severed throat and the pool of blood that had soaked the dooryard. My stockings lay at the edge of the congealing puddle where I'd stripped them off, limp red rags, but recognisably feminine. Watching from the window, I had seen more than one face glance toward the house, frowning with the realisation that Brianna was himself's daughter, a fact the wise kept well in mind. It was Roger who had turned the tide for her, though, with a cool stare that brought the Lindsay brothers to heel behind him, axes in hand.
"It's her kill," he said in his husking croak. "Do what she says."
He squared his shoulders and gave the other men a look that strongly suggested there should be no further controversy. Seeing this, Fergus had shrugged and bent to seize the beast, one-handed, by its spindly tail.
"Where will you have us put it, madame?" he asked politely.
The men had all laughed, and then, with sheepish glances and shrugs of resignation, reluctantly pitched in as well, following her directions. Brianna had given Roger a look of surprise, then gratitude, and then, the bit firmly between her